Now we're ready to begin question 9. If people used to expect prices to rise at 2% a year, but expected inflation now has risen to 5% a year, then yada, yada, yada. To do this kind of a question, your mind has to be triggered by words. Here the words are expected inflation rate. Now when you think about it, you'll remember that we have a formula in which nominal interest rates equal the expected interest rate plus the real interest rate. I equals R plus E sub I. And using that formula, you know that if people expected prices to rise at 2% per year, that was the expected interest rate was 2%, but now they expect inflation to rise at 5%. So the only question is whether real interest rates have also changed. For that, you had to think back to our discussion of inflation, because it is inflation, rising prices, which causes expected inflation to change. And ask yourself what happened to real interest rates. In the last lecture before exam 3, we did a discussion of money and interest rates, and you saw in that experiment that we increased the growth rate of the money supply, and that real interest rates fell at first but then rose back to where they were before. And so real interest rates are not affected very much in the long run. Now, so the best answer is nominal interest rates will increase by exactly 3 percentage points, but real interest rates will not be affected very much in the long run. There are other possible answers, which I'll mention briefly. One, interest rates will decline, since purchasing power is now is eroding much faster than before. Well, that's just not true. That and if you believe that, you need to listen to the lecture. It is available on the from our webpage. Go to macro lectures, recorded lectures. The next possible answer, wealth obviously will be redistributed in haphazard ways, since expected inflation always equals actual inflation. Lenders will gain and borrowers will lose. Well, that's pretty much of a word salad, but to make use of that, those words, to decide whether they're true, your mind has to be triggered by certain phrases. And the redistribution of wealth being redistributed, that those phrases would be triggered in your memory by the discussion of redistribution costs of inflation. And the way that discussion went, if prices are changing and people don't know it, then the borrowers and lenders, when the loan is being repaid, either the borrowers or lenders got a worse deal than they expected, and the other party got a better deal than expected. It is when inflation is not expected that wealth is redistributed from the borrowers to the lenders. But in this problem, expected inflation changes. And when inflation is expected, wealth is not redistributed. Now, what about another possible answer? Nominal interest rates will be affected far less than real interest rates. which will increase. Well, again, this to get this, to reject this answer, you needed to listen to the discussion of money and interest rates. And that lecture is available on the internet. You need it before the final exam to get the 3 or 4 points from this kind of question. But you'll remember from that lecture that nominal interest rates are affected quite substantially, but real interest rates drop a little bit and then come back to their original level. So that answer doesn't make sense. So there's only one answer which is true. Now, moving on to question 10. Your instructor probably believes the following. 1. As a general rule, the government not borrow money to pay for current consumption expenditures and instead should pay for them with taxes. That is a true statement. Current expenditures, the argument is similar to the argument for your personal finances. If you borrow money in order to pay your day-to-day living expenses, then in future periods you'll have less spendable money, less disposable income, because you're using part of it to repay the expense of your borrowing. And so it's not an ongoing situation to be borrowing money for such a purpose. The same goes for your government. Now, statement 2, as a general rule, the government should not borrow money to fight a war and instead should pay for them with taxes. Well, if anything, I would believe the opposite, that you should not be fighting a war. A country should not be fighting a war unless there is some long-term benefit from doing so. And if there is a long-term benefit, then it does make sense, at least it's possible, to pay for such a war with borrowing. So that statement seems to me is probably false. So the correct answer is only statement 1 is true. All right, question 11. Suppose that 2 major U.S. banks unexpectedly fail. Many citizens lose access to their checking accounts for several weeks. Also, assume the Fed stupidly does nothing, does not buy or sell government securities, does not lend at the discount window, does not change reserve requirements. Evaluate each of the following statements and select the best answer. Refer to the money supply equation given just above if this helps you. So statement 1, X sub D and X sub T in the equation will increase because many bankers will fear a banking panic. That statement is correct. X sub D represents the larger of the required reserve requirement, R sub D, or the reserve requirement that the banks want for purposes of prudence, which in our symbols is S sub D. Go back and over your derivation of the money supply equation to refresh your memory on that, or listen to the lecture which is available on the web. Statement 2, the public's desired ratios of currency to demand deposits and currency to time deposits will increase. Yes, that statement is also true. As we discussed, in times of financial uncertainty, such as Y2K, when we went from the year 1999 to the year 2000, at times like that, people are afraid, if people are fearful, they will tend to get extra cash, and so the ratio of currency to other types of wealth rises. Statement three, the money supply will increase because people will want to hold more cash than before as a safety factor. Well, I don't know. Even if you believe the money supply will increase, and I'm pretty sure that if you plug some numbers into the money supply spreadsheet that I made available to you, you'd find that it's more likely to decrease than to increase. But even if you do, does the money supply increase because people want to hold more cash than before as a safety factor? Well, if anything, the desire to hold more cash has probably a tendency to make the money supply decrease rather than increase. And in addition, that's not the complete reason. And it might be a correct statement if it said that the money supply will increase in part because people want to hold more cash than before. But that's definitely an ambiguous answer, or an ambiguous statement, may not be true. So the correct answer for question 11 is statements 1 and 2 are correct. By the way, the first several questions on this exam are very difficult questions. Now comes question 12. In the money supply equation just above, assume that C sub T equals 50, T sub F equals 130, L sub F equals and so on and so on and so on. Then, and which is the correct answer? And the correct answer is B, the money multiplier is 1.0. Now to get that right, first of all, you had to know what the money multiplier was. And the money multiplier is the fraction in the money supply equation. That is 1 plus 1 over R sub CD divided by 1 plus X sub D over R sub CD plus X sub T over R sub CT. And so you need to calculate the size of the money multiplier. And to do that, you had to remember what I told you about the values of these different terms. For example, X sub D is the larger of the reserve requirement, R sub D, or the prudence requirement, S sub D. Well, which one is the one? R sub D is 0.4, S sub D is 0.3, so the larger of the two is 0.4. So X sub D is 0.4. And R sub CD equals 1, and so you have 0.4 divided by 1 for the first fraction in the denominator. The second fraction in the denominator is X sub T divided by R sub CT. R sub CT equals 1. X sub T is the larger of R sub T, which is 0.1, and S sub T, which is 0.6. So the larger of the two is 0.6. So therefore that fraction becomes 0.6 divided by 1. So the denominator of the multiplier becomes 1 plus 0.4 plus 0.6, which is 1 plus 1 equals 2. The numerator is 1 over R sub CD, 1 plus 1 over R sub CD, and R sub CD equals 1. So you have 1 plus 1 over 1, which is 2. So the entire multiplier is 2 divided by 2, which equals 1. That makes B correct. The money multiplier is 1.00. The money multiplier 1.34? No. The money multiplier some other number than given in A or B above? No. If C sub T increases to 75, the money supply will grow by more than 25. You'll have to calculate that, but I'm not sure. I haven't done the calculation, but I expect that is bogus. And obviously, both C and D are correct. That cannot be the right answer. So the correct answer is B. The money multiplier is 1.00. Question 13. In the money supply equation just above, if the money multiplier is 0.6, then if the Fed sells $5 billion of Treasury bonds and at the same time puts $5 billion of new currency into circulation, what will happen to the money supply? Well, looking back at the equation, T sub F is going to be is going to decline by 5, become $5 billion smaller, and C sub T is going to become $5 billion larger. So the sum of C sub T plus T sub F plus L sub F is going to be unchanged. And an unchanged thing times a multiplier is going to be unchanged. So the money supply will neither increase nor decrease. This is the correct answer. Question 14. If in the aggregate demand, aggregate supply model, as presented in the text and the lectures, the two curves intersect to the right of full employment output. Now, yeah, go ahead and draw the diagram, and you'll immediately remember that diagram as one in which there is an inflationary gap. So, statement one, that there's a deflationary gap, that statement is false. Statement two, prices and wages will begin to rise, shifting the aggregate supply curve upward. That statement is true. You remember that we went through the reasoning on the inflationary gap and how it causes wages to start rising. Where the two curves cross suggests that there's an equilibrium in the goods market. The supply of goods and the demand for goods are equal. But when there is an inflationary gap, that means that the resources are overemployed and are looking to find someone who's willing to pay them less money and be able to work less. And there's a shortage of labor, and wages are tending to rise, and rising wages mean rising costs, and that's what causes the aggregate supply curve to be shifting upward. So the correct answer is only statement 2 is correct. Question 15. The increase in world oil prices in 1990 initially, and the answer is, caused the aggregate supply curve to shift upward due to higher costs per unit of output. Now you might also think that another answer caused the aggregate supply curve to shift upward as wage rates quickly adjusted. But that is not an accurate description of why the aggregate supply curve shifted upward. Shifted upward because of the cost of oil, oil being the input. It didn't shift because of a rise in wage rates. Whether there's a rise or a fall in wage rates would happen later, would be an effect rather than a cause of the initial shock. And none of the other answers really make any sense at all. Then question 16, stagflation. What is stagflation? Well, you have to You have to look it up or have read about it in the Wall Street Journal. Stagflation is a condition in which output is falling and prices are rising. In other words, we have inflation as a difficulty for the economy, and also we have a recession at the same time. And stagflation has occurred from time to time in the past when prices are rising. Because of increases in the price of oil or crop failures or some similar sort of supply shock. If you did not find the phrase stagflation in your textbook, nonetheless, you should be able to make a lucky guess at the correct answer, because the first part of that word, stag, probably stands for stagnation, and the second part, flation, probably stands for inflation. And so that's probably why many of you got that problem right. Question 17, a labor union anticipates a 7% inflation rate in each of the next 3 years. It wants to obtain a 3% increase in real wages in each of those 3 years. To obtain this goal, the requisite nominal wage hike it should negotiate is how much? Well, here percent change in prices, which the labor union expects, is 7%. And the percent change in real wages that they insist on is 3%. The formula to use is percent change nominal equals percent change in real plus percent change in prices. The percent change in real that they want is 3%, percent change in prices is 7%, and so they need a percent change in nominal of 10%.